The Spendthrift 80s, Part 2. More fads. Sneaker mania. Long a utilitarian gym shoe to be shoved into the corner of a musty locker or under an unmade bed, the sneaker emerged as the decade's most fashionable footwear, especially among youths. Gone were the days of the simple black canvas high top with a rubber sole. It was high-tech footwear, engineered to give an athlete a competitive edge in running and jumping. Made variously of leather, suede, and nylon, the shoes might have shock-protective heels or heels of molded thermal plastic with air-cushioned soles and inflatable air bladder collars. Designer sneakers like Nike's $110 Air Jordans or Reebok's $170 Pump were pitched to kids who literally begged, borrowed, or stole to get the money for the status footwear. As the decades ended, the entire sneaker industry reported sales in excess of 400 million shoes, up from 347 million the previous year. Converse claimed that 58% of their revenues came from children 18 and under. Upscaling the sneakers began in the 60s with companies like Adidas and Puma, and was carried to new heights in the next decade by Nike. The working superwoman of the 70s made sneakers a high-heeled alternative for walking to the office. Furthermore, an emphasis on fitness and jogging, the popularity of Jane Fonda-like workout videos, helped promote specially designed shoes. But the real mania came in the 80s when kids, particularly inner-city kids, adopted footwear as a personal statement. Shoe companies said the high prices of sneakers was due to high-tech innovations. UCLA professor of social psychology Harold Kasserian summed it up in an incestuous supply and demand cycle when he told Newsweek in 1989, "The world doesn't need $200 sneakers, but it doesn't need Hostess Twinkies either." By that time, several shoe manufacturers to display their social responsibility and, of course, to quell negative publicity, had begun the pump of some of their profits back into the nation's inner cities by refurbishing school gyms and outdoor basketball courts. Rubik's Cube. In 1974, the Hungarian architectural professor Erno Rubik designed a challenging puzzle, a cube with a cluster of cubelets, for his students. It was meant to be a mental exercise, not a frustrating experience. The six-sided plastic cube had 9 colored squares set in rows of 3, and the rows could be rotated to achieve different color configurations. The object of the puzzle was to align the cubelets until each side of the cube displayed a single solid U. The horror of the challenge lay in the fact that the cube could be aligned in trillions of different patterns. Rubik's Cube, retailing for about $6 to $10, was first marketed in America in 1980, and for the next year and a half, much of the country became obsessed with solving the puzzle. Worldwide sales topped 100 million, bringing lasting fortune and fleeting fame to Erno Rubik. Millions of people never did solve the puzzles, others aligned the colors in under a minute. For a while, a 16-year-old boy held the record at 28 seconds. A British mathematician solved the cube in 50 calculated moves. The media, punning with the cult of cubists, reported that a compulsive woman developed wrist tendonitis from rotating the cube's rows, while another woman filed for divorce, citing as grounds her husband's single-minded infatuation with the cube. At the fad's height, more than 50 quickie books were published offering stepwise solutions. Erno Rubik attempted to duplicate his runaway success with a spin-off puzzle like Rubik's Magic Snake and Rubik's Revenge. But true to a fad's one-time windfall, they never ignited a mania. Wacky Wall Walker. Harvard MBA Ken Hakuta was operating a small import business in Washington, D.C., when in 1982, relatives in Tokyo sent him a box of teikos, a Japanese term for octopus, that described a gummy, spider-like toy when hurled against the wall, slowly descended limb over limb under the grip of gravity. And teikos rechristened wacky wall walkers for the American market. Hakuta glimpsed his future. He dropped his import lines of ironing board covers and karate uniforms and secured the U.S. right to distribute the toys, which in Japan were popular among small children. Within 5 years, he sold 220 million in colors of red, green, blue, yellow, black, and rechristened himself Dr. Fad. Mr. Millionaire could also have described him. The toy, manufactured in Japan, cost about 20 cents to make. Hakuta sold them for about $1.90. By his own accounting, he earned a profit of $20 million in the fad item in terms of longevity, outlived Rubik's Cube and the Pet Rock. Not that happened overnight or without great effort. Lacking money for advertising, Hakuta initially made the rounds of city toy stores, hurling wall walkers to the nearest wall and hoping the gadget in motion would sell itself. When the toy caught on, Dr. Fad promoted it aggressively around the country. And when peak interest began to wane, he cleverly pulled wall walkers from toy shelves and turned down licensing agreements to use the wacky image on t-shirts, gambling that if he made the product scarce, he could imbue it with a second life, as he did by contacting food companies like Kellogg's and Wendy's, persuading them to offer the toys as premiums. Kellogg alone stuffed 75 million wall walkers into its cereal boxes mid-decade. Wendy's not only offered the wall walker as a premium with the purchase of a hamburger, but also launched a national advertising campaign, saving Dr. Fad the expenses of promoting his own product. In the meantime, Dr. Fad was busy promoting himself. The savvy Hakuta published a book, How to Create a Fad and Make Millions of Dollars, hosted a syndicated television show for children, and was awarded the Inventor of the Year Award from the Franklin Institute in Philadelphia. By this time, the untiring Fadmaster had followed his wacky wall walkers with three related spin-offs, Sticky Hands, Space Darts, and Rocking Rollers. Dr. Fad and his wall walkers became one of the decade's great widget success stories. Slap wrist bracelets. It resembled a thin 9-inch ruler, but with a downward flick against the wrist, it curled around the arm to become a bracelet. Popular among the schoolyard set, slap wrists sold for $2.25 in 1990 and were dubbed by one Fad observer as a Venetian blind with attitude. Produced by Main Street Toy Company of Connecticut, slap wrists were initially turned down by several major toy companies that didn't believe the invention of Stuart Anders, a high school shop teacher from Sun Prairie, Wisconsin, had any Fad potential. Anders in 1983 was experimenting with thin steel ribbon, which he observed that a strap upon impact with the wrist curled into a circle. He demonstrated the ribbon to a friend who represented toy investors, and in 1989, slap wrists of polka dot and solid colored sheaths were ready to debut in the annual New York Toy Fair. Unfortunately, the snappy product was easy to rip off. Soon the market was flooded with imitations, not all as safe as the originals. Slapping a strip of paper-thin metal against bare skin lacerated many a youth's arm. As the Fad was peaking, Anders said, "I'd like to think slap wrists will last 30 years." He then modified the slap-happy forecast, "But I know it won't. I hope it falls somewhere between Pet Rocks and the Hula Hoop." Nerd pride. It was the most ironic form of popularity to be seen in the 80s. Pride in being a nerd. "I'm a nerd, and I'm proud," read a fast-selling t-shirt. Nerds even developed their own language, geek speak. Modern popular culture has long featured with derision brains and eggheads, high IQ folks interested more in books than dates and booze. Of more recent origin is the term nerd. A milquetoast in white shirt, baggy pants, black-rimmed glasses, who carries pens in a plastic nerd pack in his shirt pocket. The term is thought to derive from a California surfing jargon of the 60s, referring to an inept, ineffectual person. A geek, according to the Contemporary Dictionary, is a street performer who shocks the public by biting off heads of live chickens. Thus, neither a geek nor a nerd was necessarily a brain. The association of the slurs with high intelligence arose in popular culture at the time when Woody Allen, the nerd's national hero, began to gain popularity. The same period witnessed the rise of the computer genius or hacker. Whereas in movies, the scrawny, neurotic Allen always got the beautiful woman, in real life, the hacker whiz manifested cool by such acts as breaking in the Pentagon computers, or as was the case with Apple Computer's founder, Steven Wozniak, by becoming a millionaire before the age of 30. Nerd took a different light. Seminal transformation of the nerd to hero occurred in the movie screen in 1984 with Jeff Canoes' The Revenge of the Nerds, which depicted how a geek fraternity masterfully took over a college campus and won the respect of the shapeliest female students. 2 years later came Lucas, featuring a gangly geek who not only is interested in girls but tries out for the football team. Hollywood was mining the social misfit. Stand By Me, the story of a skinny nerd who blossomed into a successful writer, and Peggy Sue Got Married showed the triumphant return of the abused nerd of physics lab to his 25th high school reunion. He became a famous scientist admired by his former tormentors. Television, too, cast nerds as heroes. ABC's hit series, The Head of the Class, was the antithesis of the previous decade's Welcome Back, Kotter, featuring a classroom of not of dumb greasers, but of geeky geniuses. The kids, all social misfits, wallflowers, and loners, had that prized information age commodity, brain power. The rise of the nerd brought with it a trend of dressing like a nerd, plus nerd cereals, candies, geek greeting cards, and even a mechanical wind-up geek doll. As members of the Harvard University Society of Nerds and Geeks point out, there are few countries in the world where anti-intellectualism runs as high in a popular culture as it does in the United States. The group cautions that if America does not learn to laud its brains and eggheads, as do our economic rivals in Eastern Asia, the 21st century may witness a monetary battle in which Asian nerds and geeks are pitted against such American heroes as overpaid jocks, pop rockers, and sitcom heartthrobs. Well, we'll leave the fads there and come back next week because there's lots of others left to go. Now, the source for this is Panotti's Parade of Fads, Follies, and Manias, The Origins of Our Most Cherished Obsession by Charles Panotti. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.